Did you hear what I said? Mary, where are you? At 7 o'clock in the morning, there will be mass in this room due to a mix-up in the breakfast last year. We're having it especially for Jim. Any of you other Catholics who would like to attend are more than welcome. Now, did you hear the other announcements?
I heard that.
Now, I'm going to sit down and shut up before I do, Dina.
Shall we bow our heads in a moment of silent meditation? And those who care to, join me in praying the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and to help others recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. I'm Dina, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dina.
Hi, folks. It's sure good to see everybody. When Deborah asked me to introduce Cora Louise, I felt it was an honor and a privilege. Cora Louise and I have several things in common. We're both female-type alcoholics. We were both born and raised in Mississippi. I'm sorry, reared. Ann Lander says hogs are raised and children are reared. It was in my drinking that I became hog-like, but I was reared. We both lived in the same town, Greenville, Mississippi, several years ago. She went away and got sober in New York quite a while before I did. But I came back to Mississippi many years later and got sober. But Wichita is now my home. Everybody that has met Cora Louise already, I know, is anxiously awaiting to hear. I've heard nothing but good about her, and she's so sweet. She says she's been sober since 1957, and she's worked in the GSO office in New York since 1965. And I know she's done an awful lot of good work for us. Now, my group and the people that know me know that I've got a big mouth, and when I get it open, I can't shut it. So they said, don't disgrace us. Please shut up and sit down and listen for once, would you, Dina? I said, okay. I know you're waiting. I am Cora Louise B.
Thank you, Dina, and hi, everyone.
Hi.
I am Cora Louise Belfort, and I am a very grateful recovering alcoholic. And isn't this incredible? Wall-to-wall alcoholics for miles and miles. I can't believe what I'm seeing out there. I love the introduction I got from Dina. Several years ago, I was introduced by a lady, and I think it is unlike any other introduction I ever heard in my life in AA. She had met me at the plane, and I was going to speak at the Sunday morning spiritual meeting. And this is the way she introduced me. Before I begin, I should tell you that I arrived in Tennessee for this meeting from Honolulu, where I had been visiting my daughter. And I had on a dress that I had bought in Honolulu, flowery and bright and so on. So at any rate, we'd had a marvelous weekend, and when she got ready to introduce me at the Sunday morning meeting, she said that she had been asked the year before to go to the airport and meet the lady speaker from New York. And she took a sort of dim view of this New York floozy that was coming down. And the sweetest little lady you would ever want to see in your life got off the plane, and everybody loved her. And that was our beloved Hazel that we lost a year ago. And she said, and then I went to the airport this year, and the floozy that I thought I was going to meet last year got off the plane this year. I always wear a navy blue dress when I travel on airplanes now. It's wonderful to be here with you, and I think we've had a perfectly marvelous weekend. Once again, I'm so grateful for the fact that we don't have to compete with one another in AA. Because after the speakers we had last night, Neil and Charles, and after the ones we've had today and the wonderful Al-Anon speaker that we had, if I had to be in competition with these people, I would just have to say thank you and sit down. But I don't have to do that. I have my own story to tell. And I welcome the opportunity to do this, because this is the story of the transforming experience of my life. And I hope that some way in the process of telling you my story, I will be able to express to you in any way at all the depth of my gratitude to AA for making it possible for me even to begin the process of trying to become a different and, I hope, better kind of person by way of the AA program, the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, and the concepts of service. Because during the years that I drank, I became the kind of woman that I never wanted to be. Destructive, irrational, unpredictable. I have so many things to be grateful for, as we all do. I know each one of us in our own separate ways feels that we are the luckiest people in the world. And I think that all of us are. All of us in this room are the luckiest people in the world. But what I can share with you are my own particular reasons for gratitude. I did come into AA in 1957, September 6, 1957. So I have just recently celebrated my 15th anniversary. I can remember my first one, and I can remember thinking, this can't be happening. It can't be me. It has to be somebody else. And I felt that way every single year that's rolled around. And this year, 15 years, I just can't believe it. I can remember when I was chairman of my group in New York, and the first meeting that we were going to have after I became chairman was the 15th anniversary of a woman, and she happened to be on the staff of the General Service Office. And I thought, just imagine, 15 years. But it's not years, it's days. It's just one day at a time. As somebody pointed out last night, maybe it was Neil, as Wes says, if we can count to one, we can make it. One person for one day, not taking one drink. And this is how it all came about. And through the help and support of people like you in hundreds of places all over this country, I can never speak about my gratitude without remembering the very deep sense of gratefulness that I feel for the fact that Bill and Dr. Bob, through the grace of God, met one another 37 years ago this past summer in Akron, Ohio, and began this process, which is still going on all over the world, and for which none of us can foresee an end, of one alcoholic speaking to another, talking in the language of the heart. It has been my great privilege and pleasure to be a member of the staff of your General Service Office in New York since 1965. And really, second to finding sobriety in AA, this has been the greatest experience of my life. The first 2 years I was at GSO were like the first 2 years I was in AA. I was on a pink cloud, and I was learning something brand new every day. And the more I learned, the more I realized how little I knew. One thing that I learned that first year, and I hope I never forget, was that I had a great deal more to learn from that office and from the work there than I had to give to it. And that I hope that I would be able to remember this and to make the effort to the best of my ability, but to realize that I was what really the one who was on the receiving line. I would like to be able to stand here for the whole evening and talk to you about the office. But if you're like me, that's not the first thing that you want to hear from any AA. You want to hear what I want to hear, I think, which is how it was, what happened, and how it is now. When I went to that first meeting 15 years ago this past September, I would not have believed that the day would ever come when I could look back on the years that had preceded my arrival there and accept the fact that, for me, they were probably the necessary preparation for the kind of thing that I've found since coming into AA. As Dina and I were propped against the wall, nervously awaiting 8 o'clock a little while ago, she said to me, "You know, I'm glad I'm an alcoholic." And I said, "You know, I am too. Because if it weren't for that, I wouldn't have this." Now, I didn't know any of that when I went to that meeting 15 years ago. I didn't know that I probably was one of the people who had to experience the painful and often humiliating experiences of those drinking years. If I was ever going to be able to take part in any kind of self-confrontation, a really good, hard, honest look at me, just like I am. Charles talked about this, Neil talked about this, Father John talked about this, Donna talked about this. This is what we all have to do if we're going to stay here. And I don't think that I would have been able to do it if it hadn't been for the experiences of those preceding years. I thought I already knew how to do this, and I thought I had already done it. I had had many years of psychotherapy, and I thought that I was capable of introspection and of looking at myself as I really was. But it was only after I came to you and put myself in your care that you showed me how to do this. You gave me steps, and you gave me traditions, and you shared your experience, strength, and hope with me. And I began to learn, little by little, to face some of these things that I really did not want to look at. And some of them I'm not crazy about looking at even yet. Always in the weeks that precede my anniversary, I tried to take a kind of inventory, a fourth step. I work on the 10th step daily, and I think of that as my daily housekeeping step. But some days I'm in a hurry, and I have to shove things to the back of the drawer, put things on a closet shelf, and say, "Well, I'll open that package and put those things away later." And then the time comes when I have to do a sort of general house cleaning in my own house and in my own life. And this is the fourth step. Well, this year, for the first time since 14 years ago, since my first fourth step in AA, I tried to do it like it tells you in the book. I tried to write this down and take a look at where I am now And I was so surprised at what I found out. I didn't really learn anything new about myself. The things that I put down there were things that I really knew. But I had learned to look at these things in a new way. I had learned to see things in these character defects that I had not seen before. I had seen the sort of far-reaching nature of some things that I had thought of as rather minor flaws that didn't need too much attention. Now, this came as a great surprise to me. And in certain ways, I was quite humiliated by the whole thing. I thought I should have made more progress than this. I thought I should be farther along the way than this. And this one particular thing, which I had thought of as being so minor, was something that I was really very embarrassed to admit, even to myself. And I thought, if I'm this embarrassed to admit this to myself and to God, I better admit this to another human being, and I better do it quick. So I called up a friend. I had to go out of town on an AA speaking date, and I asked if she would ride with me to this town in New Jersey. And while we were in the car going out there, I tried to take my fifth step with her. And it's been a wonderful experience. I'm so glad I did it. I'm still the same person that I was before I took that fifth step and that fourth step. In many ways, I'm still the same person that walked through the door and came into AA 15 years ago. But the direction of my life has changed. The direction of the way I think has changed. I'm able to cope with some of these things now in a way that I wasn't. And this is really all that I claim for myself, is a change of direction, and a change of direction that is significant. Because I hope the change of direction is towards choosing what God's will for me is, rather than choosing what my own will for me is. I'm not sure that I always know the difference. But I pray for the wisdom to know the difference at any rate. When I first began this process with you of this self-confrontation, I immediately learned a few things. And when I say I learned them, I don't mean that they were mine once and for all. I mean that these are things that I became aware of, that I still have to remind myself of every single day. I learned that I not only don't, but that I can't control anything or anyone by my efforts alone, not even myself. I need help in this. And when I took this fifth step a couple of weeks ago with this friend, I had the same sort of sinking feeling that I had when I took the fourth step the first time, that I cannot possibly cope with all of this. And the truth is, I can't. But the truth also is that I don't have to, because I have help, and I can turn this over to the power greater than myself that I call God. This is the kind of help I need, the kind of help that I get from people in and outside of AA, and the kind of help that I get from a power greater than myself that I call God. I learned that I don't have to be a winner. I always thought I had to win. If I didn't think I could win, I didn't play. It was as simple as that. I know now that maybe the only times in my life that I ever really won were times when I seemed to be losing. For instance, when I lost the battle with booze, thanks be to God. I learned that I have the right to be wrong. Several other people have mentioned that this weekend. But this was something that I didn't know before I came here. I have the right to make mistakes and errors in judgment and poor choices. I have the right to fail, and to fail in things that matter deeply to me. And I believe that the only thing that would really be fatal would be if I should cease to care, if I should cease to try to practice the principles of this program, if I should cease to be fully committed and truly concerned about the principles of this program and about the power greater than myself that I call God, who's seen me through this much, this far, along the way. And I've learned to think of this road that I'm on as a journey, not a trip. I'm not on a trip that has a beginning and an end. I'm on a journey. It had a starting place, but as far as I know, there's no stopping place. And it's not a journey that I have to take alone, because I can take it hand in hand with all of you and people like you everywhere, and with the help and support and guidance of the power greater than myself that I call God. Now, I don't give this impression necessarily, at least I know I don't to some people, but I really never have been a person who had very much faith in my ability to accomplish anything worthwhile. But I learned after coming to you that it's not really very important whether I have faith in myself or not, so long as I have faith in the power greater than myself that I call God. And so long as I place my reliance in that power that's greater than I am. So long as I place my reliance there where it always should have been. Now, I don't know why I happened to be one of the lucky ones who got here. I know that I did not do anything to deserve all these blessings that have come to me. I know that I'm no more worthy of all these things than any of those people who are still out there and still suffering. But I do not pretend to understand the mind of divine providence. I am only grateful beyond anything in my life that I found you when I did. I began to drink with anything that you might call regularity, sort of late in life for an alcoholic. I was not a teenage drinker or a high school drinker or a college drinker. I was 26 years old, married, and the mother of two little girls before drinking was anything but a very occasional thing in my life. And while my husband was overseas during World War II, I played my role of the tragic little war widow up to the hilt. I acted like I was the only woman in the country whose husband was overseas. There were millions of us, but I thought I was the only one. And I knew there were millions of others, but somehow they were different. There was one thing I found, though, that wasn't different about some of these others. They used to like to get together in the afternoon, and we would turn the children loose in the sand piles and on the swings and sliding boards, and we would all sit on the porch and share our experience, strength, and hope together over a few drinks. And I thought this was wonderful, and I thought, where has this been all my life? This is absolutely the perfect way to nurse the children in the afternoon, and I love this. I love the fact that I seem to have a good head for booze. I love the fact that I had the reputation of being the one who could drive the car home from the picnics. I think when they issued me a driver's license, they expected me to be able to drive the car home, but this seemed like some remarkable achievement to me. I love the fact that, you know, I could lead the conga chain around the mountain's edge without falling off, at least not very often. We didn't fall very far. I love the fact that I was the one who could fish the ones who had rolled into the picnic fire out again and douse them in the water. All of this seemed great to me. When my husband came home from overseas, he noticed that drinking had become a daily occurrence in my life, and he remarked on it, but not necessarily with criticism. He just noticed it. I thought when he got back that all the things that had been such a problem for me while he was away would be solved, that the magic wand of the fairy godmother had been waved, and that we would live happily ever after. We moved to New York within a very short time after he came home from overseas. And things didn't work out just exactly like I thought they were going to. We had a few problems. A lot of people have a few problems. Everybody has a few problems. It looked for a while as though we might be war casualties. Still, drinking was not the problem here. I was drinking more, true. But I was never drunk, and this was never the cause of our difficulties, at this time at least. At any rate, after about 6 or 9 months of this, after he'd been home from overseas for about a year, it was finally decided that I should have some psychotherapy, and I resented this very much. We had problems, but I had to go to the shrink. I didn't think this was quite fair. However, I really did want to solve our problems very much. I wanted this marriage to work. I wanted to be a good wife. I wanted to be a good mother. I wanted to live a worthwhile life. And so I was willing to undertake this. Now, this was tough going. I was about 27 or 8 at this time. I began with this psychotherapist, and I went to see him 3 or 4 times a week for about 18 months. Everything was going just fine, according to the therapist. It didn't seem fine to me, but he said it was going just fine. And then one night I went to a party, and I was drinking in the usual manner and in the usual amounts. Only this time something very strange happened. I got terribly drunk, and I had a blackout, and I was completely unprepared for either one of these things. I had always taken a rather superior attitude toward drinking. That if one couldn't drink well, that is, like I did, one simply shouldn't drink at all. You can see I had a long way to fall from my lofty perch. I had never even heard of a blackout at this time. I had fallen down a flight of stone steps and landed on my head on a stone terrace the night before. And I thought I must have a brain concussion, and that was why I didn't remember anything that happened. I was too ashamed of the cause of this fall to go to a doctor, but I did discuss it with the psychotherapist. And this was the first and the last time that I ever mentioned drinking to this man. I continued to see him for 7.5 years after that, and we never discussed drinking again. The only way I found out what he thought about alcoholism was to discuss my brother's case with him. Some days when I would be in the taxi in rough shape, I never did show up drunk, not actually drunk. I would show up, you know, the next morning after the night before. Some days I would be in the taxi on the way to the psychotherapist, and I would have to rack my brain about what I could make up to tell him that could have happened to get me in the shape that I was in without having what really had happened, that I had just drunk a fifth of whiskey or something like that, you know. I never could discuss it after that, but I did discuss it with him this day, and he said to me all the things that I wanted to hear. He said them in innocence, of course. He told me that this thing that had happened to me was the kind of thing that could happen to anyone occasionally. That in my case, he thought it might even be a good sign. It might even mean that the therapy was finally piercing this very tough armor, and that we were going to open things up and all was going to be grand. We opened things up all right, but it wasn't so good. He also said that he thought it was indicative of a difficult period, phase that we were going through in the treatment. And he suggested that until such time as we resolve these difficulties, perhaps I should be extra careful about any drinking I did. Careful. How that word careful came back to haunt me. I tried so hard to be careful. I tried every way that I could think of to be careful, every way that anybody could suggest to me to be careful. The trouble was, though neither the therapist nor I knew it, I had already lost the ability to be careful. Neither one of us knew that I had already crossed whatever that line is that separates people who can drink from those who can't. Neither one of us knew that drinking had already become the most important factor in my life. Now, I don't mean by that I ever was drunk every day, or that I got drunk every single time that I drank, because this really never was the case. What I mean was that from that time on, the question of to drink or not to drink motivated practically everything that I did. I couldn't ever just do anything and just do it. I had to sit down and think, now, should I drink or not? If so, should I drink before I go, or should I wait till the end of the evening when I won't have time to have more than two drinks? I made all my plans in terms of, if I plan to do this, then I can't drink. And some days that's what I wanted, and some days that was not what I wanted. It really had me on the end of a stick. Not only that, of course, from that time on, I lost the ability to call the shots. I was no longer able to say with any certainty, even to myself, and I was the only one I talked to about my drinking. I didn't talk to anybody else about it. I was no longer able to say that I would be able to be sober at a given time and a given place. I could not, however, admit the fact that I had reached the point of no return as far as drinking was concerned. I simply couldn't believe this. And I really did believe. And in this, I had the support of the therapist and my family and a great many people who knew me well, that if I could only find the key that would unlock the door and emancipate this person that was buried inside of me and free this creature, the real me, as we called it, I would be able to put some order in my life, and that in this order, drinking would fall into its proper place. Well, I began a search for this real me, and my life became something straight out of Alice in Wonderland. I had to be prepared to believe seven impossible things every morning, just like Alice did, and I had to run faster and faster all the time just to stay where I was. I was frightened. I knew what was happening to me. I didn't know what to do about it. I thought I was doing the only thing there was to do about it. I was still having treatment. I'd found out he believed that if you could clear up the symptoms, resolve the personality conflicts, that, you know, alcoholism would go away, that there was no such thing. I realized that I was shriveling up and drying up inside like a leaf on the tree in the autumn. I was aware of this growing sense of emptiness and this sense of isolation and alienation. And the more frightened I got and the emptier I felt, the faster I ran. And the only way that I knew to quiet these fears and to fill this emptiness was with the contents of a bottle. And so time after time, knowing full well that this oblivion, this blotting it all out that I saw, would not solve anything, that when it wore off, I would be confronted the next day with all the same problems, and that in addition, I would have to cope with the horrors of my remorse. I don't have to describe that to any of you I know, because you know too well what I mean about this terrible sense of self-contempt and self-loathing that is the inevitable aftermath of the kind of drinking that we do. I searched for this creature, this real me, in every likely and unlikely place that you can imagine. And I endowed this search with every ounce of energy and imagination and resourcefulness that I had, and this was considerable. I continued to look for it for another 7.5 years in psychotherapy. He could hardly be expected to help me with a problem that I categorically refused to discuss with him. I looked for it in books and study. I was always running off to take a course at NYU or the New School of Columbia University, thinking if I could only learn the wisdom of how other people had lived, that maybe I could apply some of this to my own life. But I didn't read any books about people like me. There didn't seem to be any situations like mine. I thought if I could lose myself in a worthy cause, in things, something that was bigger than I was, that this would vanish and fall into its proper place. But I didn't find anything that big. I looked. I looked everywhere, but I didn't find it. I looked for it in domesticity and home life. I couldn't clean up anything inside of me, it seemed. So therefore, everything outside had to be just exactly right. After all, I didn't want anybody to say, well, she's full of booze all the time. No wonder her house is such a wreck. I would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and go wash my hair so that nobody could say I had let myself go to pieces because of drinking. I never gave so many parties as such elaborate ones. A lot of times people would show up at these parties that I wouldn't remember having invited. And every now and then we'd have a little trouble getting the food up off the floor and onto the table, but I had them. I searched for it in my room. I searched for it in my religion, which I had turned my back on a number of years before. But I had it all wrong. I had it all backwards. I went to church trying to make sure that God knew what my will for me was. I had to come here to learn that it works the other way around. I even searched for this creature at Ebbets Field in the days when my beloved Dodgers were still in Brooklyn. And there was a method in this madness. My family all just thought I was a kook, which I was, but I did have a point in this. During the summertime, the children were away, and this meant that the few controls that I did allow to work in my life were gone, and the drinking got very much worse. And I thought if I could get my family to give me a season ticket to all the Dodger games, I had to get on the subway and go from New York to Brooklyn and back again, maybe I wouldn't drink so much. And so 77 times every summer, I got on the subway and I went to Brooklyn and I came back again and I discovered beer. Beer and baseball. And the vendors at Ebbets Field discovered me. And when they used to come around at the end of the seventh inning on their last trip, they used to leave 3 cans of beer with me instead of the usual 1 that I got at the end of every other inning. Simultaneously, always, inevitably, I was searching for my answers too in the contents of a bottle. And here I really did always find a key. But the door that the key unlocked was not the door I was looking for, because it was the door to a Pandora's box of destructive, irrational, unpredictable behavior. The chaos and confusion that I created in my own life and in the life of my husband and children and all those people who were close to me by this attempt of mine to live 2 separate lives, one on a fairly rational plane, and the other on the dark, irrational side. This finally brought me to the point of despair where nothing seemed worth the effort anymore. The gap was too wide between this person who made some attempts, at least, at worthwhile living and this creature who was so beset by obsessive and compulsive drinking that she poisoned or kicked over every good thing she did. This gap seemed to me too wide ever to bridge, and I could not imagine that the bridge existed that would span it. I concluded that I was some sort of no-good freak who had had every kind of opportunity that a person could be given in life and still couldn't make the scene. And it was in this burnt-out and beat, despairing state of mind that I finally came to my first AA meeting. Because in the midst of all this self-hatred, this despair, I had had a moment of truth. I had called up the children's pediatrician and asked him if he could come over. He was a neighbor and a friend. Asked if he and his wife could come over and spend the evening with my husband and me. I had a problem with one of the children that I wanted to discuss with him. He came. I was not drunk when he arrived. I was not sober, but I wasn't drunk. And I was a good hostess, so I was pouring the whole time they were there. He listened to me. He knew me well. Been around us a lot. He listened to me, and after a few minutes, he said, I'm going to interrupt you now, and I'm going to say something that's going to make you very angry, but I have to say it. He said, I don't think that this is the cause of the problem you are having with your child. But I don't think you can solve the problem you're having with your child or any other problem you're having unless you do something about your drinking. I think it's out of control. I want you to let me call Dr. Ruth Fox, who's a specialist in alcoholism. She's a good friend of mine, and I want you to go to see her. He was right about how mad he made me. I was really mad. I was not mad at him. I was mad at my husband because I thought my husband must have been talking to him. I didn't give the man credit for having eyes, ears, nose, any of those things. I said to him that I would not go to see Dr. Fox, that no more money was going to be spent on me in psychiatry, that I would have to find another way. And then I tried to get rid of him and get him out of the house as fast as I could so I could give my husband hell, which I proceeded to do. And then I spent the worst week that I have ever spent in my life. The drinking took on a desperation quality that it had not had before. My husband became not just furious with me and disgusted with me, but downright frightened. He was considering calling this pediatrician. We didn't have a doctor of our own at this point. I wouldn't go to a doctor. He might tell me something. We called the pediatrician when either one of us got sick. So Lee was going to call the doctor and ask him what he could do for me. Ask him if he thought I should go to a hospital, if he could give me some sort of sedation or something, because I was just out of hand. I spent the worst week I've ever spent. The doctor had been there on a Thursday night. The next Friday, Friday before Labor Day in 1957. At about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, when I'd postponed taking the first drink as long as I could, when I came into AA and they told me to postpone, I already knew all about it. I had been postponing for years. And the latest that I could make it would be 4 or 5 o'clock. I had postponed taking the first drink till about 4, and I started to drink as I had on 1,000 other days. And with the very first drink, I had known as I had on 1,000 other days that this was going to be one of those days when there just was not enough booze in the world to do for me whatever it was that I seemed to need so desperately to have done. And all of a sudden, I had this sickening shock of recognition of the helplessness and hopelessness and near despair of my situation. I really hated what alcohol did to me. I had hated it for years. And I was so sick and tired of it all, and I had been so sick and tired of it for years. And all of it just seemed to come in on me all at once this particular afternoon, and I got up and I walked to the telephone without giving it a thought. I had no plan whatever in my head. I just went to the phone and called my husband. And for the first time in my life, said something to him that was appropriate about my drinking. I said, "I know I'll be drunk when you get home tonight. Please try not to be angry. Please try to bear with me this one more time, because I hope it may be the last." And then out of the blue, I reached out and I found the words that subsequently saved my life. I said, "If you'll call AA and find out where their meetings are, I'm willing to give it a try." I said, "I don't even know whether I'm an alcoholic or not. I know if I am, it isn't my fault, but it most certainly will be my fault if I don't try to find out and do something about it. Besides," I said, "we know that AA has helped lots of people with a drinking problem, and it doesn't cost a thing, so what have I got to lose?" What did I have to lose? Only those things that had been weighing so heavily on my shoulders all those years that I'd almost sunk from the weight of them. Things like anxiety and alienation and loneliness and estrangement and despair. And what did I have to find instead? All those things I had been looking for in all those unlikely places. Things like faith and friendship and meaning and purpose in my life. My husband was absolutely dumbfounded by the telephone conversation. We hung up, and as I put the phone down, it rang. And it was the children's pediatrician. And he said to me, "I want to know whether you've been thinking about the conversation you and I had last week or not." And I sat down. And I said, "This is uncanny." that you should call me right now. And I told him what had just happened. And he said, my God, I wouldn't have dared suggest it. That's the very best thing you can possibly do. Then he proceeded to tell me about patients of his whose parents were in AA and how wonderful it was and how this was exactly the right thing to do. And I said to him, Milton, I'm scared to go alone. Do you think it would be too childish of me to ask Lee to go with me? Lee is my husband. He said, if Lee doesn't want to go, you just call me up and I'll take you. Just go. Well, after that, I felt just fine, and so I had to have a couple of drinks to celebrate this big decision. And I always say I got to AA through the grace of God and through telephonitis. Because after I had a couple of more drinks, I got on the telephone and I called up all my friends to tell them my big news. And not one of them said, you don't need that. They all said, isn't that wonderful? And the next day when I woke up, I really should say came to, I began to have second thoughts about this moment of truth I had, and I was ready to back out and try again at least one more time. And the phone began to ring, and it was all my friends who knew my ways. They knew that I was apt to telephone one night and forget all about it the next day, so they called up to remind me about my decision, and I was stuck with it. I had to do it. Now, this was the Saturday before Labor Day, and I had company coming for the weekend. Heavy drinking company. My sister and another old friend. Now, I knew enough about AA to know that you didn't taper off here and that you didn't learn to drink moderately. I knew you stopped drinking. And so, very nobly and tragically, I drank nothing during this weekend. And I didn't crack a smile. And I waited on everybody, and I was the martyr of the world. I drank water till 4 a.m. while they drank a fifth of bourbon each, I think. At any rate, came Tuesday morning, and everybody had gone, and my moment of truth had really arrived. I had to go to the AA meeting that night. I was sick at my stomach all day. This is the hardest thing that I have ever had to do in my life. I really have tried very often to try to figure out why it was so terribly difficult for me. For one thing, I know I was one of the people who was guilty of contempt prior to investigation. I thought it was fine for those poor souls. I don't know what I thought I was, but that's what I thought about it. I wasn't even sure that I was an alcoholic in spite of all the things that had happened. A lot of things hadn't happened that I thought had to happen in order to qualify you as an alcoholic. I had never been hospitalized for alcoholism. I'd never even had to have a doctor take care of me for drinking exactly. I certainly had never been in any trouble with the law. I had never been a morning drinker. I didn't usually get up in the morning. I couldn't. But I had been a postponer. I had not, you know, I knew I had to eat. I was trying to protect my right to drink. So I'd stand in front of the icebox and eat a half pound of Swiss cheese before I had a drink. So this meant that I didn't drink first thing in the morning. I avoided all these things that I thought were telltale. I always measured the drinks and I always put ice in the glass. And I didn't think alcoholics did that. So, I hadn't done a lot of things that I thought you had to do. And in tangible ways, I hadn't lost a lot. I still had my health and my home and my family and most of the friends that I cared about. And I still had the price of the next bottle. I think the reason that it was so terribly difficult for me to admit that I was an alcoholic was that I wasn't at all sure that I could stop drinking. And so, therefore, I was very reluctant to admit that there was any necessity to try. So, as the time approached for me to go to this meeting, I was literally scared to death. I was sick with shame and humiliation. I felt that I was permanently broken in spirit. I found out later that this highly tutored spirit that I thought was broken was my will and my pride. That was what had been broken because they didn't know how to bend. And I hope they never fully recover. But it was new to me then. I was bleeding and it hurt. And as we walked out of the door to go to that meeting, I can remember standing on the steps and holding on to the rail, saying to myself, boy, you have really done it now. You have really gone to the end of the line. You have lost your way. You're about to take a plunge into the darkness. And little did I know that that darkness would turn out to be better than light, and that way that I had lost, the way that I found would turn out to be better than any that I had ever known. I'll never forget that first AA meeting. I remember it better than I remember meetings last week or even last night. I remember everyone that was there. I remember every word that was said. I hadn't had a drink for 5 days. And this was the moment, as far as I was concerned, when through the grace of God, the screw was turned in my head and the door began to open and I began to be able to listen and I began to be able to suspend opinion and criticism and analysis and judgment and instead to listen and consequently to learn a little bit. I will never forget the man who was leading the beginners meeting. He said one of those pithy little homey truths that you hear in AA and no place else. And these were the words that turned me on, where thousands of dollars of psychiatry had done nothing and where all the counseling that is available in a big city like New York had left me untouched. These were the words that turned me on. He said, you know, being alcoholic is a little bit like being pregnant. You can't be a little bit alcoholic any more than you can be a little bit pregnant. And I thought, I'm a little bit alcoholic. But I could see it. I could see that once you were started, there was really no turning back. And he went on to say that there was one difference, that alcoholics never did miscarry. They always went to term. But when I think of the serious and solemn efforts that had been made in my behalf, and here were the words that turned the screw, and suddenly I heard. I was terrified. I couldn't say anything, but I began to listen. And this was a beginner's meeting, and so the man finished, and he asked if anybody had any questions, and my husband put his hand up, and I thought, oh, God, what's he going to say? What's he going to say? So he said something about, you know, well, what do you do when you're just so anxious and uptight and tense and nervous, and you feel as though your nerves will break if you don't have a drink? And the man who was leading the beginner's meeting said, what is your particular monsoon hour, sir? And I said in this tiny little voice, he's not talking about himself, he's talking about me. And I began to cry. And I think I continued to cry for months, but mostly it was crying for joy after that. We went downstairs at this meeting to the open meeting. And unlike most meetings in New York, there were no women speakers that night. This was a very rough bunch. Three men, all of whom had sort of Bowery backgrounds. Well, my husband got terribly nervous, and he was whispering to me, maybe I shouldn't have brought you here. You never did anything like this. Maybe you don't belong here. And the wife of the man that was leading the beginners meeting that I had just met said, oh, I do hope you'll go to a meeting tomorrow night. They're not all like this. They really aren't. Usually we have women speakers, and usually they're not this way, really. Please try to go again tomorrow night. Well, I was too polite to say anything to her, but I did say to my husband, why don't you shut up and let me listen to what they're saying? Now, this was a miracle, believe me. My husband had every right, knowing me, to be nervous, because he had every right to expect that I would clobber him over the head when we left there and say, how dare you take me there amongst the, you know, people and so on. but the screw had been turned. The mind had been opened. And instead, what occurred to me, and I deserve no credit for this because it was totally unlike me. Instead, what occurred to me was, if these people could have been so sick and could have had so little to get well for, if they could do it, maybe I can do it. I don't think I would believe any of the things that I saw. I didn't believe what you told me, even. I just believed what I saw. I wouldn't have believed it in a book. I believed what I saw. I believed that you knew what you were talking about. I believed that you had been where I was and that you had suffered what I was suffering, and that if this had worked for you, maybe it could work for me. And before long, AA became for me, and it still is, a kind of school. And ironically, after a lifetime of exposure in the academic community, it's been here in AA, among my own kind, ex-drunks, that I began the process of learning the things that I'd really always wanted to know, which were how to live a life that had meaning and purpose. And in all of this, I found the tools from the experience of people like you. I found the courage from your unfailing strength and support. And one day at a time, a whole new world, a whole new and very much better world, began to open up before me, and I began, little by little, to begin to face the realities of my own life. And I wish I knew how to give thanks for all these things, but I don't. I don't have the words. I will never have the words. So I have to try to give partial evidence of my gratitude by love and service to this fellowship and to the people in it who showed me the difference between despair and hope, between futility and a kind of fulfillment, between slavery and freedom, really. Now I have one story that I'm going to tell you. I tell it every time I speak at any AA meeting, because it seems to me to maybe put in a capsule what my life was like and what was expected of me in this life and what I did with it as a result of alcoholic drinking. I had buried this story. I had absolutely put it out of my mind. And when I had to make my first talk in AA, I thought I had nothing to say except that I drank too much, too long, couldn't handle it, got in trouble. But I just didn't know how I could describe what I had gone through and all the circumstances of my life that made my drinking so terrible. And all of a sudden, this story occurred to me. And it made me sick when it occurred to me, but I knew I had to tell it because it did make me sick. And I've been telling it ever since. Not because it's the worst thing I ever did, not by any means, but simply because I believe it illustrates the total picture better than any other. My husband is an Episcopal clergyman. He is also the chairman of the Department of Religion at New York University. He is a teaching clergyman, in other words. Two years before I came into AA, he asked me if we could have a dinner party for the faculty and staff from his department at NYU, and I consented to do this, of course, and I worked hard to make the party a success. About 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I was all through my chores, and I was tired. And I thought I'd take a little nap before the company came at 7 o'clock. And then I had one of those inspirations that occurs with such depressing frequency to alcoholics. I thought, maybe I'll have a little glass of wine to help me become drowsy. Now, I knew perfectly well that a little glass of wine didn't make me drowsy. I knew it took a little bottle or two little bottles of wine to make me drowsy. And I also was one of the alcoholics who knew long before I came here that it was the first drink that got me in all the trouble. I didn't know how you stay away from the first drink. I thought I was still capable of applying reason to this. I applied reason to it all the time, and it never worked, but I still thought that one could apply reason to it. So I said to myself the famous last words that I'd said on hundreds of other occasions, that any fool would know enough to be discreet at a time like this, and I took the drink. And you know the rest. I didn't have the luck to pass out. I never did. I didn't have sense enough to leave home. I never did do that either. I showed up at this party, and I showed up almost falling down drunk, near hysterics, as I always was when I drank, muttering what I hope was incomprehensible gibberish. I say this with feeling, because what I had to say was not very complimentary to my husband, and it was not expressed in the language that people normally associate with a clergyman's wife. Now, the people at this party were total strangers to me. I had met one or two of them, but that was all. We're Episcopalians, and Episcopalians take a rather relaxed attitude towards social drinking. Nobody took a relaxed attitude towards my drinking, which was, I guess, antisocial. But the people at this party came from temperance-type backgrounds. These people didn't even smoke. These were the kind of people that I call squares. You talk about arrogance. Here I was, the boss's wife, clergyman's wife, hostess, drunk and disorderly. And I had the nerve to refer to these people in what I intended to be insulting terms. And I must say, they behaved extremely well in what you will agree were rather difficult circumstances. One of the people at this party was a colleague of my husband's that I had known for many years. He and my husband were working on their doctor's degrees at the same time, and this man had written his doctoral study on alcoholism, and his book became a classic in the field of alcoholism. So when I was dropping the ham and the turkey and the shrimps all over the floor, he came in to help my husband and me get it together and get it on the table. I've often wondered why he didn't say anything. They didn't believe in intervention in those days. But he didn't say a word. Just help me get the food up off the floor and onto the table, and help Lee to try to keep me out of the way and to quiet me down and stop me from cursing so much. The day after this party, my remorse was spectacular. I wanted to pull the covers over my head and never come out again. I simply wanted to find a hole and crawl into it with the rest of the rats. But I was so locked up in this miserable little alcoholic trap. I was so involved with my own agony and self-hatred that I wasn't even able to tell my poor husband that I was sorry. I thought he ought to know I was sorry. I thought he ought to know no one would behave this way if she could help herself. Maybe he knew that, I don't know. But I do know that after that party, he knew that I no longer drank because I had unresolved personality problems. I drank now because drinking had become my number one problem. Now, you might imagine that a stunt like I've just described would constitute a bottom for somebody in my life and circumstances. But I drew no such conclusion. I just was not ready or willing to stop drinking yet. I did decide something had to be done about the drinking, and I set about doing it with some success and more than I deserved. But I don't recommend my system to anyone who hadn't already tried it, because I learned some new things about loneliness. I had thought I knew what it was to be lonely. And the fact that I had no reason to be lonely, with a fine husband and two wonderful children and what should have been an interesting life, the fact that I had these things and still felt as though I would die of loneliness only convinced me that I was a freak and reinforced all my feelings of inadequacy. But after this party, the loneliness became a really morbid thing, because I decided that I wouldn't do any drinking at all when other people were around. And before long, I, who have always been a gregarious kind of person, no longer cared very much about being with people. I didn't want to make plans to do things with my husband and children in the evenings and during the weekends. I no longer even cared whether my husband sat and talked with me after the children went to bed at night. I just wanted them all to get the hell out and leave me alone to drink in peace. Only, of course, there wasn't any peace, because there isn't any peace in solitary confinement. and booze had made a prisoner of me. I was really a lost soul in chains. And even though my chains may have been crepe paper ones, in my opinion, these are sometimes the very most difficult ones to break. Now, thanks to AA, I'm no longer a prisoner. I have a choice. I can take one drink with all its consequences, or I can do it the AA way and stay away from one drink for one day. I no longer feel like a lost soul, because at long last my life does have some shape and structure and direction to it. Some not very well defined goals, but the goals don't matter as long as I have those steps and those traditions, this program that lead me wherever I'm supposed to go. I can and often do fail miserably in the performance of my various duties and responsibilities, but I've learned here to get up and start all over again, practicing the principles of these programs, of this program, a day at a time. They do not let us down if we keep at it, if we just keep on keeping on. When I go into low spells, and I do sometimes, and I get into the old negative ways of thinking, and I get terribly disappointed with myself and very critical of myself and everybody else, and I find that I'm beginning to kick the furniture and curse under my breath again and talk to myself and say things like, oh, well, maybe you sold yourself a bill of goods after all. You work awful hard and you haven't got very much to show for it. What's so different about your life, really, except that you're sober, except that I'm sober? When I came here, the only thing in the world, the only thing in the world that I was looking for or even hoped to find was sobriety. Everything else, everything, and there's been so much that my cup runs over. I found new happiness in family life and in the well-being of my husband and my children. I found what it is to be a friend and to have a friend, and to be able to look into the eyes of another person and see that person and not just my own image reflected there. I found that I can hold a responsible job, and I now have one that I really love, working for all of us in an AA job. I found new joy in the practice of my religion, and all of this is gravy, because the only thing that I was looking for was sobriety. And if I want to know what it would be like to lose that, all I have to do is to remember how it was those last 2 years when I drank alone late at night, wandering through the house, up and down the halls and up and down the stairs, always going down for that one last drink, 25 trips a night for that one last drink. And I remember that I used to think even then that there must be some purpose in this. I must be looking for something that's missing from my life. And even in my drunken confusion, I was right about that one thing. I really was looking for something. And thanks be to God, I found it. I was looking for AA. I was looking for all of you. I was looking for the power greater than myself that I call God. And when I look out at you now and realize that all through that terrible time, there were people like you in rooms like this, and that you always have a vacancy, I see what a wasteland my pride and my willfulness and my blindness had made of my life. And I thank God I found you when I did. I'm not proud of these things that I've told you. I spent years trying to forget these things and others like them. But I know now that I never must forget, lest I forget to be grateful to God for helping me to find AA. Lest I forget to be grateful to AA for helping me to find my life. Thank you.